Today's Tay Show will be on case 30 in the Blue Rock Collection, the Heikigan Roku. Case 30 is entitled Joshu's A Big Radish. Main subject, a monk asked Joshu, I have heard that you closely followed Nansen. Is that true? Joshu said, Chinshu produces a big radish. Secho's verse, Chinshu produces a big radish. Monks have taken it as their model. They only know how it was and would be. How can they realize the swan is white, the crow is black? Plunderer, plunderer. The monk had his nostrils threaded through. To thank everybody for coming here this morning on this beautiful, beautiful day. After we sit for a while, we have gone outside and experienced this incredible morning. Really amazing. I wonder if we would have experienced it if we had started our day a little differently. You know, it's possible to get up on a Saturday morning and turn on the television or NPR and listen to the news, make breakfast, or watch TV. You might not even go out of the house until afternoon. You know, you might be inside the whole morning and maybe you read the paper. You read the paper, you make breakfast, you watch TV, listen to the radio. You might have a lot on your mind. You know, maybe you have to go shopping today, or you have to go to Home Depot and get some paint to paint the bathroom. There's always something to do. You know, you have work from left over from the week, and you have to sit down for a few hours at your word processor. And all during breakfast, you're talking about, you know, some problem at work, or you're talking about some problem with your children, or you're talking about something, politics, well, you know, something Mitt Romney did, maybe somebody he beat up when he was a little kid. Somebody else he beat up, I should say. So, you know, that's a typical day, and, you know, basically we're projecting a little bit ahead of the moment all the time. You know, you're in the moment, but there's already like this forward thrust into the, you know, you're sitting here drinking your tea, but already in your mind you can see Home Depot. And it's like you're gathering up the energy of a spring, you know, it's like compressing a spring. And you're going to have your coffee, you're going to shave and wash your face or put on nice clothes, and you're going to get in the car and drive to Home Depot. And everything you do in the morning is sort of happening in the shadow of Home Depot or in of this event. Or you're sitting there and maybe you didn't have such a great Friday and you know, you're trying to focus on the news, but something's happened on Friday that, you know, is clinging to you, and you're using the news sort of to get away from what happened on Friday, but, you know, you can't quite get away from it. You know, this is very, very typical. You know, if you look at your mind as you're going through the day, it's often the case that we're projecting into the future, or we're dragging the past along with us. And this is like a typical human condition, right? And so much of what we do is not really, we think we're being reasonable, but we're not really being reasonable. My father, you know, always used to love the sports, to read the sports news, and I think it gave him a tremendous sense of release from his pressures at work, you know. And if, you know, if you said to my father, do you like sports? I don't know, I guess he would have said yes, he likes sports, but I think, you know, he read the sports page because it gave him kind of time out from all of his problems. and he could get caught up in these other things. And I think after reading the sports page, he felt better, no matter what team won or lost. You know, it was, really wasn't about that. It was about getting away from stresses in his life, you know. And I just think this is how most people live. You know, there's a sort of an undercurrent of tension, I think, in the modern world in general. It can be energizing, but there's a sort of an undercurrent, I think, sometimes of tension. You know, we're all on the clock. We're all very highly regimented, and we're very goal-directed, you know. So, you know, I know that my wife makes these lists. They're like, I'll find them around the house, and there'll be like lists of things to do, and they go on for quite a long time, and I'm not sure we ever get all the things on the list done. And before we even finish one list, she's making another list. Now, this is actually excellent. I mean, my wife is very well organized, and I myself am not always so well organized. So I respect it. But, you know, this is sort of like when she gets up, she starts making a list or looking for her list and trying to get through the ticking off the items on the list. And I guess this probably sounds familiar, a little bit familiar. So, you know, it's quite... different when people you know, get up in the morning and come to a place like this and sit down on the cushion for an hour and a half or an hour, and basically you're really working on bringing your mind into the present, you know. But it's difficult often. You know, when you sat down on the cushion this morning, you might have been tired. So you're struggling with being fatigued. But probably all kinds of things sprang up as you were sitting, you know. Yesterday I had a difficult day at work because somebody in my program was very upset about something and basically was blaming me and I knew the meeting was going to be difficult. This is a good example of what I'm talking about. The meeting was set for 4:30 in the afternoon, and I had a very full day. So, you know, all day long I'm going through these various tasks that I have to do. I had to get my grades done and get those turned in. And then I had to meet with a bunch of people individually and as a group, and I was doing some other kinds of things. And then I knew that at the end of the day I had this meeting, and the meeting was going to be sort of like a fight. You know, so all day long I sort of knew it was coming, and it was just like this. It was like having to, you know, I can remember having to go out on the playground and play, and then having to come back in the building, but the bully was waiting by the door, you know. And it's like, all, you know, I can't really have any fun because I know the bully might beat me up as I go back into school. And you can't really put the bully out of your mind. It's like you know this is coming, right? Well, this person is not really a bully. I don't think that's fair to say. But it was like that. I felt like, you know, at the end of my day, I was going to have this fight. And I tried to manage it as skillfully as I could. You know, so when the conversation started out, I wanted to be conciliatory. And I wanted the person not to blow up. And yet I had to ask this person to do something that that she didn't really want to do. So, you know, I knew it was going to be trouble, and I had been thinking about it really for days, and you know, I tried to finesse it, but at the end I could see it blew up, right? It was just, I didn't manage to control it, and the person, you know, didn't throw anything at me, but the person left with the, you know, sometimes you get a look from somebody that says, you'll be sorry, you know, or I'm going to get you for this, you know. You don't always get those looks, fortunately, but when you get them, you know you've gotten them, you know. So I know that on Monday, this is going to trail me for, like, there are going to be repercussions from this meeting. This person is probably going to try to get her allies to assist her. And they're going to try to gang up on me, and so on. So this is normal human life, you know. It happens. Sometimes these things happen. So, you know, when I came into the sit this morning, you know, I was, this was all shadowing me, you know. And I sat down on the cushion and I started working on my breath. And there it all was, and it's replaying in my head, and I come back to the breath, and, you know, pretty much the two sits this morning, the first sit and the second sit, were sort of just like working through these issues, you know. I mean, some of the time I'm sort of like going over the tapes in my mind of what happened, and thinking about whether I had done everything properly or not, And I had various kinds of emotions. I was anger, anxiety, and so on and so on. So, you know, I spent a lot of the time just going through these events. And of course, this event, you know, as I'm working, this event keeps popping up, and I come back to the breath, and it's popping up. And then I think of other things. I do think of, the bully at school, you know, I thought of that. I thought of other events in my life, for some reason I thought of, you know, my parents and their difficulties and you know, this is a typical sit, you know, so it would be nice to just come in, sit down on the cushion and, you know, everything is just, your mind is empty, you know, you're serene and so on, but, you know, this is something that really had to be worked through, you know, really had to be worked through. And the function of meditation is partly to do just what I did this morning, you know. You have to ask yourself, you know, if I came in this morning and I sat down on the cushion and I could just bliss out, you know, how good would meditation really be? Because, you know, I really have to deal with these events from yesterday. I really have to deal with them. And if I don't deal with them on the cushion, I'll deal with them in other ways. You know, I've probably talked about this before. My father had a real drinking problem. You know, he was actually an alcoholic. And he was, very a functional alcoholic, you know, but he drank prodigious amounts and he had health problems. He actually died of cancer because not only did he drink a lot, but he smoked all the time. When I was a little kid, I would come into the bathroom and my daddy would be there. And he would be shaving and he would have a cigarette hanging out of his mouth while he was shaving. If you've seen the show Mad Men, that actually happened in Mad Men too. It reminded me so much of my father, where Don Draper's shaving and he's smoking at the same time. So, you know, my father would come home from work and he would be he would have events just like what happened to me, you know. And he would come home and he would drink until he got to a place where he felt liberated, you know, from his anxieties. And smoking and drinking would make him feel liberated, you know. I don't think, my personal feeling is that that's a very good strategy for getting free from these things, because you're not really working them through, you're just sort of papering them over, you're just repressing them. So, you know, my father wouldn't really deal with these problems. I think he would try to get away from them. And I just think that's not necessarily a good strategy. Sometimes we really do need like a break. You just need a time out. And that's okay. You know, sometimes you've just been so stressed you don't want to deal with it. Like when I came home last night, I came home late at night after the evening sit. And my wife said, "How did it go today?" And I said, "Oh, brother, you won't believe it." And she said, "Well, tell me about it." And I literally could not bring myself to describe what had happened. I tried, but it was like my brain just froze. I just couldn't do it. You know, it was just enough, you know, enough today. This is enough, you know. And I said, you know, please understand. I appreciate you're trying to help, but I just can't bring myself to go through all these events again, you know. So sometimes you do need a time out, you know. You just sit down and relax and just be in, you know, try to be a little happier maybe having a beer is okay or something like that. But sooner or later, you know, you have to work through these events, and today was my opportunity, my golden opportunity to deal with these events, you know. So I sat down on the cushion and all of this replays, and I think about whether I handled it right, and I think about it this way and that way. And after a while, you know, you relate to the events in a deeper way, and I think that means you begin to realize how you feel about what happened, you know. So you're not just analyzing anymore. You're sort of like becoming aware of your own responses, you know, on an emotional, on like a gut level. And you realize, or I realized, you know, I have a lot of fear about, you know, this event. I also have some anger. I feel this person has been unfair to me when I tried to be a good guy. And I had other emotions too, you know, and all of this came out on the cushion. By the end of the sit, you know, I was feeling kind of tired, you know, actually. I really like tired. The last 15 minutes were difficult. I think I had been concentrating very hard, and I was sort of like out of gas about 15 minutes too soon. So I had to just sort of hang in there for the last 15 minutes, and it was difficult, you know. So then we got up and I went to the bathroom, and we all went outside, and it was just so wonderful, you know. Because you know, it's not just a beautiful day, but for me anyway, I'm looking at the sky or I'm looking at the flowers, and I'm in a kind of a thoughtless state. So, you know, in front of my eyes, in front of my eyeballs, there is this beautiful garden. You know, they did such a good job. Some of you might remember that it took about 2 summers for them to get that all complete. You know, we were having sitting over here, and it seemed like every weekend they were banging around, and it just took forever to get that done. But they've done a nice job. I think it actually is quite a beautiful little spot. And it's perfect for doing kinhin. In the summer, we don't have any people around here, so it's just wonderful to do kinhin. And you go out of the building and walk around. And for me, anyway, my mind was so blank and clear that it was like staring into a pond and being able to see the bottom of the pond, you know? Normally, when we look in the pond, there's so much murk and gunk in there, and so much algae, you can't see the bottom. But after a couple hours of zazen, or after two and a half hours of zazen, you know, your mind can get to be very clear. And it's like you're looking at the surroundings, but instead of having all this stuff running while you're looking with your eyes, instead of having all this other stuff running on the screen in your head, right, you're just empty back there, you know. So you're looking with your eyes, but your mind is empty. You know, normally there's like two screens, right? There's what we see with our eyes, and then basically there's the screen in our head. And if you look at that, it's a different reality often, you know. So, you know, last night I was sitting in my living room, but there's a on the screen inside my head, I was replaying the events of the day, especially that 4:30 meeting. And so, you know, when my wife was talking to me, I almost couldn't focus on her at all, because I got so absorbed in replaying these tapes in my head. And I kept trying to pull myself back into the moment, but it was very, very powerful. And I had to work really hard not to just be making one-syllable responses to my wife, like, you know, which upsets her, as you might imagine. You know? You know, she wants me to try to be present, and I should try to be present. But it was so hard because, you know, my eyeballs were staring at my wife, or, you know, but my behind my eyeballs on the screen in my head, all of these events are still playing out. And this is how the human mind really works, I think. You know, so the classic example of this, and I've said it many times, is, you know, you have a terrible day at work and you come home and the dog is barking at you and you scream at the dog, "Shut up!" Right? You're not really mad at your beloved dog, you know. I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, my brother and I had a collie named Sarge. And sometimes, you know, he would actually lick us. It was almost like we gave him a big kiss, you know. We loved that dog so much, I think we would have kissed him right on the lips, you know. In fact, I think we did, you know. He sort of slobbered on us, and it was like a big kiss. So we loved that dog a lot, you know. And yet, you know, sometimes you do that. You come home and you yell at somebody that you love or something you love. And it's you're carrying around, you're haunted by these things, right? So, you know, Zen, I think, is really quite unusual because you can go to a movie, you know, and it gives you an escape from events, but you really aren't processing. And at the end of it, you're not really present in the moment in the Zen way. You're not really focused on the moment, you know. Often what happens when you go to a movie is that you come out of the movie and you're replaying the movie in your head, you know. That's really common, you know. You'll see little kids coming out of a movie where people have been kung fu fighting, and they're reliving the movie in their minds. So that's a quite common place. If you read a book, you know, often after you read a book, you know, you're sort of carrying it around with you, and it's as though the world is really not fully present. You're still in the world of the book. TV is like that too, right? You watch TV is, of course, usually a very low quality way of killing time, and you watch TV and you get off, and you still might be carrying something from the TV around with you. But Zen is really quite unique, I think, because you know, you sit down on the cushion, you work through all of this, and when you get off the cushion, you're really not projecting anything onto the moment. If you've really been in deep samadhi for a while, or if you stick with this for a while, you'll have this experience, which is really, Buddhists think of this as the experience of liberation, where you stop projecting and you're just present in the moment. You're there with the pure presentness of the moment, and your mind is not projecting, and it's not there's nothing on the screen behind your eyes, so to speak. And this might not seem like much of an accomplishment, but it's a huge accomplishment. And when you're in that state, it is like being in heaven, in my opinion. You know, the Buddha said that most people live in a world which is like a house on fire, you know. He said, this world is burning. He said, the eye is burning. The ear is burning. You know, your sense of taste is burning. Touch is burning. You know, the world is like burning. And you think, what does that mean? What does he mean, burning? But he means that, so much of our existence is compulsive. And there's like this, we're trapped or haunted by our fears or our memories or our projections. It's very difficult to get free from those. Most people have just tiny little instants where they get free from those, right? You know, and sometimes people do it by, you know, relaxing, going on a vacation, going to Hawaii, you know, and so you have these moments where you just don't care. You're far from your work. That's close, but you might still be, you still maybe haven't made the screen blank, you know. But in Zen, you know, we make the screen blank. You know, we don't blank out. We work through on the cushion what's troubling us. And then at the end of the process, you know, we reach this state where we're not projecting. And you walk outside into the sunlight, and it's everything is crisp and clear and very alive in that condition. And that is Buddhist liberation. That is, the fires have stopped burning. You know, the Buddha, when he described the state of mind that was enlightened, he actually said, you know, I am cool and quenched. And nirvana is, the word nirvana itself means like blowing out a candle, but it could also mean like extinguishing a flame. So it's like, you know, you sit down on the cushion and it's like the mind is burning, right? You know, those events are playing in your head over and they're producing all of this emotional response, right? Anger, fear, you know, anxiety, guilt, self-doubt, you know, you go through the whole panoply of responses. And, you know, normally we just keep, you know, you might spend a whole day doing that, where you're just recircling the events in this obsessive way, you know. And many people do this. Eventually, you know, if you can't put it down, you know, it builds up. This stuff builds up, and eventually, you know, you get depressed, or you have anxiety all the time, and you have to have some kind of anti-anxiety medicine, because we don't know how to deal with that situation. But, you know, in Zen, we make a discipline out of practicing. So, you know, you can pretty much assume that there's a bunch of junk that you have to work through. Probably in any particular week, something has happened to you that is going to require you to work through it. It's very unrealistic to imagine that life could not require this kind of work, you know. You know, even if everything is going right, you will probably be distressed about something, you know. You'll probably find something to be distressed about, even, you know. But it will be genuinely distressing, genuinely troubling. So it's very unlikely that there's any person who doesn't have isn't trailing ghosts or trailing shadows, you know. If somebody says, "Me, I'm always happy," you can be sure that they're not right, you know. Really, believe me. If somebody says, I don't have any problems, I'm always pretty happy, you know, that's you. That's the voice of repression, right? I mean, just absolutely. So you know, we all have things that, I mean, you would actually be a monster if things didn't bother you, you know. You'd be like a psychopath or a sociopath, you know. I had an argument with somebody. If it genuinely didn't bother you, that would be very unhealthy, don't you think? So, you know, when you have conflict, you can't run away from conflict, but it's difficult, and it leaves residues if you're a normal person, if you're reasonably mentally healthy. And so you have to work through those. And, you know, Zen is like hygiene for your mind. You know, basically, you get up every day. Everybody understands that you need to take a shower. You know, you need to take a shower. You need to go to the bathroom. But, you know, also, what about your mental hygiene? So, you know, doing Zazen is like mental hygiene. And you sit down on the cushion, and you begin to realize, oh, my gosh, this is in there. I've got to work through this. And you clean up. And it may take a long time, depending on what you're working with. But, you know, today, for me, you know, I got pretty clean. By the end of an hour, 2.5 hours, I was feeling pretty, I was tired, but I had worked hard, and then I got up and I went outside, and it was like heaven, right? And that's really wonderful. That's really liberation. I was cool, quenched, right? Not burning, burning, burning. That is Buddhist liberation. You know, if you when you start doing Zen, and people who start meditation, you know, they often have very, very unrealistic expectations about what enlightenment is. You know, you might think that it's, when I started meditating, I was waiting for like a quote-unquote mystical experience, you know. And I didn't really know what it would be like, but I knew that it would be very different from my ordinary experience, and that would probably come in a flash, you know, and I'd be like totally transported to some other dimension. I had sort of that idea, you know. In Seattle, at the Seattle Museum, there's a beautiful Chinese statue. It's absolutely beautiful. It's almost life-size, not quite. But it's a monk, it's a Zen monk, having an enlightenment experience. And it's so moving to see, because he's not a handsome person. You know, he's a very ordinary looking person. He has sort of buck teeth, and he doesn't have a very attractive face. But his expression is so beautiful. His eyes are open wide, and he looks so happy, you know. And he's coming off the cushion. It's like whoever did this statue was so good, because you can see the motion. It's like he was sitting and now he's having his great awakening experience. And he's coming off the cushion, and his fists are clenched. And one of the fists is holding a piece, like a piece of his robe in his fist. And he's, you know, it's like he's so caught up in this beautiful experience that's just like almost lifting him off the cushion. And I used to look at that statue and think, wow, what must he see? You know, what could it be? Well, what he saw was, I think, what I saw this morning. The world without projections, without fear and attachment. And it's a beautiful, beautiful thing, you know. And you can have that experience in a shallow, relatively shallow way, or you can have it in a very, very deep way. You know, the more you have it, I think the more it gives you a different attitude towards life, you know, different attitude. Because, you know, a lot of people just don't experience liberation. You know, they just, it's very hard to find, very hard to experience and reach. And so, you know, the world is always burning, you know, and you try to respond to the burning by doing various things, you know. I mean, jogging helps, that's true. I think jogging is really great. Alcohol, not so good. Drugs are easily understood, right? I mean, if you can't get out of this situation, you know, these things that give you relief are so powerful, right? You know, people pursue power because they think that will free them, you know. But when you really work through on the cushion and you go outside and you experience that empty mind, you know, empty mind, mushin, empty mind, empty heart, you know, it's just so glorious to be in the pure presence of things without any attachments, you know, any fears. And that's heaven. That's the Buddhist view of heaven, right? It's just that. In Buddhism, that is called Tat Atta, T-H-A-T-A-T-A. Tat Atta. And the Buddha was called the Tathagata, the one who has encountered pure presence, okay, you could say. But Tat Atta, which is kind of an awkward word, it describes this experience of pure presence without projection. And it's a beautiful state to be free, to be cool. The fires are gone, and you're liberated. And the Zen life is all about this, right? Zen life is about putting this practice, this discipline, giving it an important place in your life, you know. And having those moments where the fire is gone and you're present in the moment in this very pure, very open-hearted, trusting, and liberating way, right? It's funny though, you know, people have these experiences and people forget, you know, you forget. You just get back into the habit of being anxious or being fearful or, you know, it's a very interesting thing to see. Recently, there are two people in our group who have had conflicts, you know. Neither one of is here today, but, you know, they have been practicing together for years and years and have been friends, you know, and now they're having, you know, they literally can't be in the same room with each other. And I have to say, this is just, to me, this is sad, you know. And it's crazy. It's a kind of madness, too, you know. We live in a world of imaginary problems, and you know, it's imaginary problems, really. You know, and it's sad. Humans can't always get free from those problems, but our world is so imaginary. You know, it's just the world of you know. We create these arbitrary boundaries that are—they're not real, but they take on the character of reality for us. You know, the other day I was reading about the Russian invasion of Poland. Before the modern era, Russia stole Poland. It took over Poland, and Poland got free. And then the Germans, the Nazis, rolled into Poland, and they took over Poland. And Poland was constantly trying to be Poland, you know. And, you know, these, you know, it was so difficult for people to leave it alone. And, it's sad, right, when people say, I'm a Russian, not a Pole, and I'm going to invade you, right? And I can. It's okay for me to invade you because you're Polish and I'm a Russian, right? That's sad, right? It's crazy. Really, there. You know, the difference between a Pole and a Russian is nothing, right? It's like really nothing. It's an imaginary distinction, really. I mean, I have friends who are Polish and they can understand Russian, you know, and I have friends who are Russian who can understand. And yet, you know, they've had this bitter history. And actually, you know. I've run into people who are Polish, and I've said, "Are you Russian?" And they look Russian to me, and they look so mad when I say, "What? Russian? No, I'm Polish." You know, that's actually happened. You know, and they look like, "What?" You know, but they look Russian. You know, they really do. I was reading this guy David Graeber, who's a wonderful anthropologist, and he was talking about his great grandparents who lived in a little shtetl on the Polish-Russian border. And they used to tell a joke in his family because the village was originally in Russia. And then the Poles threw off the Russians and redrew the boundaries. So now the village was in Poland. And his great-grandmother said, "Oh, thank God we're not in Russia anymore. We won't have to go through those terrible Russian winters." It's an imaginary boundary, right? And it's sad that people take them seriously. So it's sad that these two people can't be in the same room with each other. It's like, have you guys been doing Zazen for 6 years that you can't get through this? But you know, there's people get trapped. They get trapped. But when we work through some of these obstacles and we have these moments where we're in the pure presence of the moment, you know, we realize there's no Pole, there's no Russian. These are just the pure presence. That, you know, this is just the wind in the leaves, right? You know, and actually, when you're really in the presence of the moment, you don't even think wind in the leaves. You're just one with the wind and the leaves. This is really a liberation, and it's the Zen. Pursuing this experience requires discipline. You have to do Zazen, but if you do it, you will have these moments where the projector ceases, and you're in the pure presence of the moment. And this is really what the Buddha meant by enlightenment. And it might not seem very special until you experience it. And if you experience it deeply, you realize this is really quite awesome, you know, really quite amazing. And you know, so in Zen, the Zen life involves, you know, going through life, having these things that tangle us up, working through the tangles and getting back to the pure presence. And when we experience this, it's like a door opens up in our lives. We thought we were trapped, we thought we were boxed in, and now it opens. And then, you know, you thought you were trapped, you thought you were boxed in, and then it opens up. And this goes on and on. This is like the Zen way to live. You know, if you're very, very, very advanced, it might be difficult for you to get trapped by life. You know, you might be very close to untrappable. But even the Dalai Lama, even, you know, human beings, they'll trap themselves again, you know, somehow. So it's back to the cushion, and then you open up. But when you work through, and you have this experience of tat-ata, of presentness, you know, the world becomes bigger place, you know. And this is sort of what Joshu is getting at in this koan, right? You know, when Joshu is really probably the greatest Zen master of the Tang dynasty. He had an experience of tat-ata, of pure presentness that was very powerful when he was about 17. Think of that. You know, at 17, you're usually worried about your shirt and your haircut. You know, that's your big fear. You get up in the morning and think, "Oh my God, I've got to go to school. No, they'll laugh at me in this shirt. You know, I've got to have the right shirt." You know? Or, you know, you might have a pimple on your nose and you can't get on the bus because you're worried about the pimple on your nose. And this is a typical 17-year-old. Joshu wasn't worried about his shirt or his haircut. He had a great awakening experience when he was 17. He experienced that moment without projection. And he said, "Wow! What is this? What a wonderful way to live." And so instead of doing other things, he said, "I want to deepen my experience of pure presentness." And he asked around, and people said, "Well, the best person to study with is Nansen." So Joshu went to study with Nansen for a long time, maybe 35, 40 years, until Nansen died, and then Joshu was supposed to take over Nansen's monastery. But instead of that, he went out on the road all over China encountering other great Zen masters. And Joshu was already quite famous. Everybody knew he was very deeply awake, and he would go to these communities, and some people would welcome him, and some people would challenge him, you know, trying to see if they could get him caught up in knots and he would lose track of pure presentness. Sometimes people were just trying to poke him in the eye to see what he would do, right? So he's at this is in his wandering period, and he goes to some temple, and a monk comes up to him and says, "Oh, I heard you're the famous Mr. Joshu. I've heard about you. You were supposed to be Nansen's top student." So, you know, basically a less secure person would have said, "What? How dare you insult my teacher?" You know, or, "Yes, I am Joshu, you know. I have a certificate of enlightenment right here in my bag, you know. How dare you question my achievement?" Or something like that. But instead, Joshu just says, you know, in Chinshu, where he's from, Chinshu, he says, they grow a big radish. Grow a big radish. So, you know, we get trapped, but if you get into pure presentness, the world gets bigger. You know, you feel trapped and boxed in, but it opens up. How big is the radish? It's very big. It just gets bigger and bigger all the time. So anyway, you came here to practice the way of Zen. You know, all the different forms of Buddhism are actually aimed at producing this experience of tat-ata. You know, in Tibetan Buddhism, in Vipassana, they practice moment-by-moment awareness, right? They try to be aware of what's happening in terms of sensation, thought, and you just monitor what's happening from moment by moment. Sometimes you do a body scan where you start at the top of your head and you go down and just check out what you're feeling at each level of your body down to the bottom. And Tibetan Buddhism, you know, they start out by visualizing things. They in some traditions of Buddhism, in Tibetan Buddhism, they visualize like shapes. You know, you try to hold a sphere in your mind and gradually you do a cube, and you know, eventually you visualize a deity, you know, and you can see the deity and rotate it 360 degrees. All of these are just devices to produce tat-ata, the pure presence of the moment, with a blank mind, which is not projecting. So they're all going in the same direction. Our way is, Zen is thought to be like the direct, most direct path. This is not for everybody. Some people come here and they just think, well, what the hell, you know? Sitting on the cushion, you know, watching my breath, now what, you know? I had a friend of mine who really gave, he was a professor in my department, and he heard about our Zen group, and he came to the Zen group at Princeton for about maybe 10 times, 8 or 10 times, and he just quit. And I think he just, you know, just thought, you know, what is this about? You know? He was waiting for something very complicated to happen. You know, something, he was waiting for his own version of, you know, great awakening experience. He was waiting for the sky to open up or something like that. And all he got was the moment, right? And he kept, I mean, with all due respect, he probably thought, well, you know, nothing's happening here, you know, it's just the sound of the wind, you know, what's that all about? But really, if you're in the right, if you're open, your Dharma eye is opened, it's heaven. Setchu's verse. Chinshu produces a big radish. Monks have taken it as their model. This is our path, to be trapped and then to work through and open up. They know only how it was and would be. How can they truly realize, you know, the swan is white, the crow is black? It's so hard for human beings to encounter reality. You know, we think we're in reality all the time, but we're very rarely in reality. We're normally in our dreams, see. Every once in a while, we clear it all away and suddenly the real is present. It's very difficult to achieve that. How can they truly realize? Swans are white, crows are black. Plunderer. In other words, Joshu is really a great Zen master. And he says, you thief, you know. The monk had his nostrils threaded through. Like, you know, in the old days they used to put a ring in a bull's nose so you could pull the bull. They broke the septum, I think it's called your septum, isn't it? Between your one nostril and the other. They would put a hole in that and then put the ring in there. So he said the monk had his nostrils threaded through. In other words, Joshu, it sounds like he's saying Joshu kicked his ass, see. But that's not really what Joshu was about. He really helped the monk. He tried to show the monk, look, don't be attached to things like whether I'm Nansen's famous student or not, you know. And what if Joshu had come and the monk had asked him a question and the monk had asked him a question that threw him for a loop. You know, maybe Joshu starts crying, you know. What would that prove? What would that accomplish? I'm sure Joshu had times when he felt really defeated by life, you know, and he had to get back on the cushion and work it through. So Joshu's saying, look, we have bigger fish to fry, you know. Why are you trying to shoot me down? Why are you trying to, you know, what are you trying to do? What if I am a big phony? How does that help you? You know, how does that help you? Then we're both stuck, right? So he's saying, look, there's a bigger world than this. You know, let's not get caught up in this bullshit.